Hello, I'm Audrey Brown, and today in Focus on Africa, a mere 3% of trials to create new medicines take place in Africa. Professor Kelly Jibale thinks humanity is losing out by ignoring the genetic variety the continent has to offer.
If a clinical trial can work in Africa, there would be a good chance that that trial would work elsewhere, because then the medicines would be tailored to the genetic makeup of this general population, because of this direct correlation between the genetics of a population, the social and physical environment in which they live, and treatment of disease.
And we take a closer look at how financial technology is transforming businesses, big and small, on the continent. It's Monday, the 4th of November. First, we go to Somalia. Imagine facing a choice between hunger at home or risking your life at sea. That's the harsh reality for fishermen, as piracy in the Indian Ocean is on the increase again. The main perpetrators were Somali warlords who controlled one of the longest coastlines in Africa. After years of being pushed back, the problem is once again on the rise. It originally began when Somalia disintegrated during a civil war that began in 1991. An international naval patrol reduced the incidents, but the war in the Middle East and increased cargo ships going down the coast and around the Cape in South Africa has provided rich pickings for pirates. And there is also the fact that the sea off Somalia has long been subject to illegal fishing due to the fact that there was no effective government of the country's marine resources. In recent months, fishermen from Pakistan and Iran have been expressing their fears about being hijacked off the coast. The BBC's Kawun Kamush has been following the story.
Fishermen across the port who have been sailing in the Indian Ocean for decades. It includes fishermen from Pakistan as well as Iran, who spent most of their time in the sea to go for fishing. And the resurgence of Somali pirates in the area have terrorized them. We spent some time in the port to talk to them to see what's happening and how they are carrying on with their business despite of the new resurgence. And there are stories of horror, kidnapping, killing. So they are really thinking whether they can afford to continue their business with what's happening in the region at the moment. Obviously, they have been doing it for a very long time, and it's not an easy decision to make, but it has become a gamble for most of them now.
Can you spell out for us what that gamble is? What are the risks that they face given the choices that these fishermen are making? And I believe it's a choice between hunger and pirate attacks. Can you share any personal stories or statements that you've heard from fishermen who are facing this dilemma?
So one of the biggest fears they face is to be caught by the pirates when they are in the sea. Most of the times when it happens, it doesn't end well or good for them. They either become a victim of a huge ransom game or they would be attacked. Some of the fishermen told us that their boats and their crew are used as a temporary machine to attack other big ships like oil tankers. And if they don't cooperate or if they don't obey the pirates or the attackers, they would face bad consequences. This could be shooting on the deck, or if they don't manage to calm them down, they can lead their fishing boat to coastal areas and keep them there for a very long time. So we talked to one of the fishermen, Salim Khan, who survived a pirate attack last year, and he was caught as a hostage a couple of years ago, but he's still doing it.
I'm scared. Everyone is scared. But if we don't go, the hunger will kill us at home. They took us hostage in 2008. They kept us in a desert for 20 days. There was no food or water. At night, we wept in the dark so others couldn't see our tears.
That's Salim Khan. Tell us, Kawun, the background of Iranian and Pakistani fishing boats in Somali waters, because many in Somalia say that foreign fishing vessels are actually illegally there, and they've experienced a lot of frustration over this.
That's right. We have talked to, for example, some fishermen who have been fishing for generations there, like Captain Qayyum. Most of them say that there is some confusion in the sea, but they will try to limit their activities in the international waters. And if they want to get closer to the coastal areas, they would ask for some sort of permit from whoever is providing it. Well, now that these permits that we try to obtain and then we try to chase and track them down, seems that it is some of these permits are issued by different groups who could just claim that they are representing some sort of authorities on the ground, but they could be sometimes fake. Fishermen like Muhammad Ashraf pay a lot of money now to get some sort of escort when he is in the sea, but that comes with some sort of permit, which we are not sure it is genuine.
After crossing Yemen, I'll call their number using a satellite phone. They send a boat with bodyguards. At the end, they'll only let us leave the Somali coast after the payment is confirmed. The agents and middlemen are all in Dubai.
That's Mohammed Ashraf, who's a boat owner. But Kawun, do these boats actually have licenses to fish in Somali waters, whether or not they come close to, you know, the coast or not? I'm just wondering if they were taking advantage perhaps of the situation in Somalia, you know, the years and years of unrest.
They don't have licenses to fish, but because most of the time they limit the activities in the international waters. But they told us that when they want to get closer to the coastal areas, they ask for license and they contact these dealers or agents to arrange some sort of permit with security guards when they want to cross the coastal areas.
How has the conflict in the Middle East affected the resurgence of piracy? Because there was a time when they were pushed back. So what were the fishermen and others on the ground telling you about this?
I think it's still very soon to determine whether there has been a direct impact from what has been happening in the region in recent months. But most of the fishermen believe that because most of the navies in the region are focusing on the war in the Middle East, and they are now trying to be alert about what's happening across the Red Sea. It has paved the ground for the pirates to come back to the international waters and also to coastal areas to threaten the fishermen.
Somalia has a government that functions more or less right now. I'm wondering, how have they responded to the piracy, the resurgence of piracy, and how have the governments in Pakistan and Iran responded to the fact that their citizens are threatened by piracy?
So what's happening with Iran and Pakistan? They say, like, they keep telling their fishermen that, well, you have to be careful. You have to. It is not really a very solid response from them about what they have. They didn't take any measures. But as it comes with the Somali government, I can say something about that because we tried to reach them and then they didn't comment about the situation.
That's the BBC's Kawun Kamush. Here's a question. Could Africa's genetic diversity revolutionize global drug development? The region is the most genetically diverse on Earth, and yet only 3% of clinical trials take place on the continent. Most of those trials are held in South Africa and Egypt. That sounds like a waste of resources, right? But one has to factor in things like suspicions based on medical abuses committed on unsuspecting populations in Africa and elsewhere. That is not stopping Professor Kelly Chibale from making the case for more drugs testing in Africa. He's professor of organic chemistry at the University of Cape Town and also the Neville Isdell Chair in African-centric drug discovery and development. I'm wondering why Egypt and South Africa, why are they the countries where most of these trials take place?
It's basically down to two things. First of all, it's having the infrastructure. Infrastructure in the broad sense, meaning you have hospitals, you have clinical trial sites, you have a regulatory framework and a process to efficiently, you know, review dossiers for clinical trials. So Egypt and South Africa, I think, have been ahead in terms of really streamlining the process to review dossiers for clinical trials, providing the infrastructure, and thirdly, the skills. But there are encouraging signs of other countries. You may have heard about the African Medicines Agency, where last year at the meeting in Zambia, Rwanda was selected as the host country. When the African Medicines Agency, AMA, when it becomes fully operational, which is very positive for the continent, we're going to have a harmonized environment where, although the African Medicines Agency is not going to replace the national regulators, what it will do, amongst other things, is to harmonize so that we all are playing by the same standards and ethics and protocols, et cetera, which will make it easier to fast track and bring efficiency to clinical trials and attract more clinical trials, because then people that fund clinical trials will know that the standards and ethics and protocols have been harmonized across the continent.
Why do you want more trials to be carried out on African populations? Because we know that many populations regard these kinds of trials, or many of them, with great suspicion, because there have been abuses in the past, and serious abuses.
Correct. Let me pack that the issue of abuses, which I really appreciate, and I'll come back to that briefly. First of all, medicines or vaccines or anything like that is optimized on people that participate in a clinical trial. African is the most genetically diverse continent, region of the world. It's very genetically diverse. You know, if you look at East Africa, Southern Africa, West Africa, we are all very different at the genetic level. In a way, you could hypothesize that it is representative of the whole world, meaning humanity. In other words, if a clinical trial can work in Africa and different parts of Africa, there would be a good chance that that trial would work elsewhere. It's not just doing more trials in Africa, but it's also increasing the number of Africans that participate in those trials, because then the medicines would be tailored to the genetic makeup of this general population. Doing the trials in Africa, in the social and physical environment of the Africans, is really important because of this direct correlation between the genetics of a population, the social and physical environment in which they live, and treatment of disease. To your last point about the terrible things that have been done, absolutely. And I think that what we have to acknowledge is the trust deficit, whether it's effects of colonialism in South Africa, it's recent effects of apartheid in the United States. They've had issues as well amongst African Americans. But what we need to understand, and I always give this testimony as an example. When I was growing up in Zambia, in the villages and townships, you know, I will go down with malaria. I will go to the health facility that our government provided. I'll get malaria medicines and I get cured. And of course, in the absence of those malaria medicines, you know, I'll be dead. Now, only much later in life did I realize two things. First of all, that someone somewhere in the world invested in the research and development of this malaria medicine that has cured me. Secondly, that someone somewhere in the world volunteered to participate in a clinical trial for my benefit. But, you know, just because some people did bad things is not a reason to paint everybody with the same brush. The business aspect, by the way, is jobs. We create jobs because somebody has to fund the clinical trials, you know, and we know the billions of dollars that we can make from doing more clinical trials will create more jobs, will build infrastructure, et cetera, et cetera.
You see, if people lead on the amount of money that can be made, then there's also a suspicion that communities are used as guinea pigs in order to make money for other people. So let's talk about the trust deficit, because I think it's part of the infrastructure that you would need, right, in order to to conduct successful trials, along with proper healthcare, proper infrastructure, the money to develop these trials as well. So how do you build the psychosocial and practical infrastructure? How do you go about doing it?
So first of all, so when I was talking about the business aspect, the suspicion about who's making money, I'm talking about if I'm in X country in Africa, I provide a clinical trial site where that product is going to be tested. The funding that comes to support that clinical trials, whether it's recruiting nurses or recruiting, you know, buying equipment, you know, that is generating income for my country. But building the, you know, this infrastructure will require community engagement. And so that, I think, is what it's going to take, is to make sure that there are ethics that are in place, that are enforced to bring confidence and trust between the communities and the scientists.
Tell us about how African countries can actually start conducting its own clinical trials without having to count on the global West for doing that.
First of all, it's going to require deliberate and intentional government policies that say, for example, in some countries, I don't have to name names, but it's a principle in some countries, they will not approve a medicine if it has not been tested on those populations. There are countries like this in the world. They want to see data from the clinical trials generated from conducting that trial on their populations. So the starting point for us in Africa to do more trials is to make it a policy that we are not going to approve any product in Africa if it has not been tested on Africans. Secondly, it's priorities. So if we want to do our own thing, who stops us? We can put the argument of money, but money is a challenge anywhere else in the world. It's about priorities. What do you prioritize over what? If something is important to you, you are going to find a way of doing it. But I think it's a question of whether there's political will. And this is not just political will, by the way. It's also the private sector, by the way.
I'm cynical, I think. Because again, money came into fighting COVID and providing the vaccine. You know, billions was made in the course of that. But my cynicism aside, how do we then persuade African governments that this should be a priority? I mean, what's in it for them? Because we know that for very many governments on our continent, the well-being and the health of the population is not necessarily, you know, one of their top priorities at all.
We the people have the power. So when I say we have the power, that's assuming that there's democracy where people can go and vote freely and exercise their vote, because that is, you know, the one way to peacefully change and hold our leaders accountable to what they promise to do. So I think before we start blaming, you know, others, we should look at ourselves, you know, as Africans and say, what stops us from waiving visas for each other? What stops us from trading within Africa? I don't know what stops us. I'm just saying.
Thank you very much. This has been fascinating.
My pleasure. Thank you for hosting me.
Professor Kelly Chibale from the University of Cape Town. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service. The World Bank says that more than half of the adult population in Africa do not use formal financial services. For many, the services are just not available or it is not tailor-made to their needs. Economists say this puts a block on economic development. Added to this, people trying to start new businesses face a daunting 90% failure rate because they don't get the funding they need or because the banking and financial infrastructure they need is not available. But a financial technology company, Moneypoint, has managed to dodge those pitfalls and secured enough money to provide a digital payment platform across the continent. I've been hearing how they did it from Tosin Enyolorundo, CEO of Moneypoint. So you've scored $115 million, Series C funding. Just tell us, what do you intend doing with it and what is Series C funding?
Well, Series C is just a name that is given to the third major round of funding that startups have. So it starts with maybe a seed round and then a series A, a B, and a C. So it's a name that's given to the fourth round of funding that typical startups have. And we raised from Britain-based investors called Development Partners International, and with participation from Google Africa Initiative, participation from IFC, Verod, as well as Lightrock.
Is it a lot of money, $115 million?
Absolutely. Fundraising, generally, you will raise capital at a certain valuation, and the valuation implies the value that the investors have placed in your company. And typically, in a primary raise, you will be raising to do more so that the company can grow. And this fund is meant to continue growing our operations in Nigeria as well as to expand to other countries. And it's the quantum of funds that we would need to do such efforts. that determine how much you will be raising.
So tell us, what will you be doing with it? What is the issue that you're addressing with this?
So MoneyPoint is a payment business banking platform that focuses on emerging markets, originally starting from Nigeria, where we process payments for small businesses. So you could think of it as SumUp in the UK, or, you know, when you have card machines that you are using at Tesco. So that's what MoneyPoint is in Nigeria. We provide card payment systems, online payment systems, and credit for businesses, small and medium-sized. We've grown rapidly over the years to now cover as much as 80% of the market share in Nigeria, where we process about 40 million transactions now daily. So these are payments transferring from people to people, from people to businesses, and business to businesses. These are also airtime transactions or bill payment transactions. So you could think of MoneyPoint as a bank where we bank small businesses. And these are the counts of transactions that people are using our banking platform and payments platforms to do.
The World Bank says nearly 57% of sub-Saharan Africans lack access to formal financial services. I'm just wondering, does your operation MoneyPoint actually replace formal financial services, or is it answering that need?
Absolutely answering the need. MoneyPoint is in the frontier of driving financial inclusion in our markets. We drive financial inclusion by making digital financial services much more accessible to consumers and businesses. And we do this by making these services distributable in low-cost formats to our customers. The main problem for financial inclusion is access and price. It's too expensive and it's not accessible. And we solve accessibility by leveraging a deep network of agents across the operating geographies. These agents are like human banking service providers that consumers and businesses can go to get access to digital financial services.
The Nigerian economy is in a dire state. People are saying it's experiencing one of the worst economic crises in a generation. Against that backdrop, how does a business like yours come into encouraging economic growth and help businesses?
The Nigerian currency has depreciated significantly. And of course, this is one of the reasons why MoneyPoint has grown a lot despite this. But Nigeria is also going through an inflection point. Prior to now, certain policies have been overdue, one of which is the case of subsidy removal, which have finally been removed by the central government. The World Bank and the IMF have recently commended the government in all the policies that they have made, and kind of expressed some level of, you know, optimism of what the future of the country looks like. So when you combine the future optimism together with the growth, together with the fact that MoneyPoint handles payments and credits, which are fundamental to economies, you could see why we have managed to be able to still come out, being originally from Nigeria, to be able to still have massive growth that has a vote of confidence from world-class investors. However, also, we're expanding to more countries. We don't think Nigeria only should be the place where our services should be enjoyed.
Up to 40% of individuals apparently prefer cash-based transactions in Africa due to security concerns. How does MoneyPoint navigate these trust issues?
What MoneyPoint and the rest of us are doing is to be reducing the need for people to carry cash. And this is very important for us to be able to grow the continent by giving people access to digital accounts, digital wallets. There's more visibility when things become digital because it's easier to measure and it's easier to see what's going on. FinTech generally brings in digital payments and digital accounts that brings in transparency. And this can generally allow states to be able to generate more revenue, have more visibility to see where there are deficits in budgets or extra places where they can generate more revenue to power the country or to power the state and provide social services. Also, fintech is also an important capital attractor. Just like MoneyPoint has raised $110 million, which will be going to multiple countries that we're operating in. This is capital that will be used to further develop the economies and grow the gross domestic products of the countries. And this, of course, would in turn generate employment.
Where are you operating at the moment and where do you want to go next? I believe that fintech services are very good, are very well organized in Anglophone-speaking parts of Africa, but not necessarily in Francophone parts of Africa.
So currently, Moneypoint operates in Nigeria. We have operating offices in the UK, currently exploring multiple countries in West Africa and in Southern Africa and in East Africa.
Is it the case that Anglophone countries are well covered, but not so much Francophone countries?
Actually, Francophone countries are also doing very well. There's a vibrant ecosystem there that have some emerging winners also. I think while the sum of all the Francophone countries in Africa might be slightly behind the Anglophone countries, there is, however, a language barrier that creates opacity between Anglophone countries and Francophone countries. I think that if we learn a little bit of French, we might know what's going on in those countries a little bit more.
We should have learned a little bit of French quite a long time ago. So what do you think the next big startups will be on the continent?
Africa, top five countries, which includes Nigeria, Kenya, South Africa, Egypt, Algeria, and generally, one of the biggest predictors of the size of corporations is the size of the economies that they operate in. So I will generally bet that the next big startups will be coming from some of these economies, or at least operate significantly in these economies.
And what solutions will the startups be offering?
Well, in the fintech startup ecosystem, you will be looking at payment businesses, credit businesses, and cross-border and remittance businesses. I think these are the three hot areas. Businesses that allow customers, either businesses or consumers, to be able to make payments from local payments between their countries, international remittances and cross-border payments. Credit is also a big part where you are offering credits to businesses or consumers. It's going to actually be creating more markets by making it easier, faster and cheaper for the consumers that prior to now don't have access to do it. But in the future, it's inevitable that they will compete with the incumbents.
Thank you very much and good luck and congratulations.
Thank you very much, Padre.
All right then, bye-bye.
Bye.
Tosin Enyolorundo, CEO of Moneypoint. Focus on Africa was put together by Bella Hassan, Yvette Twagira-Maria, and Yasha Michelle here in London. Joseph Keane is the senior journalist in charge. Gabriel O'Regan, the technical producer. Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi are our editors. I'm Audrey Brown, and we'll talk again next time.